sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
Today you'll hear the speech by attorney and author Dr. William Pepper, given at the Left Forum in May of 2016. It's been slightly edited to fit into our time frame. The full version can be accessed on YouTube or No Lies Radio. Dr. Pepper's new book, The Plot to Kill King, provides the full truth about the conspiracy behind the King assassination. So let's begin. Here's Dr. William Pepper.
But I think it's important for us all to understand that political assassinations did not start in the 1960s, that they've been a part of human society for a very long period of time as a means of altering structures and change. So if we put all this in a context, I think it gives us a broader picture of what happened that my colleagues have been involved in researching and writing, and that I have had many ways a very depressing period of years in working on. Our moderator said I was James Ilray's lawyer for 10 years until he died. I represent the family of Martin Luther King. Martin King was a friend of mine only during the last year of his life, and I represent currently Sirhan Sirhan and worked for Bob Kennedy in 1964 as a kid when I was his citizens chairman in Westchester County when he ran for Senate. I took on those cases not lightly because I knew the victims quite well, and it took me 10 years to convince myself about Ray's innocence and non-involvement. But let's look at these in a historical way. Going beyond the Sumerians, we can start in Western civilization with Socrates and the compelled assassination of Socrates. And I say it was compelled because he took his own life, so far as we know, but it was compelled. Then we can move on to Caesar, assassins that finished Caesar and changed Roman society and Roman history at that point in time. These are basic early political assassinations. And then we can come, irrespective of religion, to the man known as Jesus, who was also assassinated by power figures and structures in his own time, Orthodox and Jewish leaders, as well as Rome, whom he caused a great deal of discomfort to. And I'm one of those people who has done a fair amount of research on his life for about 17 years when he was in India, and realized that when he went from Lhasa and traversed India, the Brahmins wanted him killed. And he had to flee India and come back to his native land because he was insisting on meeting with untouchables. And he was threatening a structure that to this day exists. I have in my work the creation of a seminar on the Dalits, who are today and for 3,500 years have been enslaved in India as the impoverished people of that country. So we have Socrates, Caesar, Jesus, and then we can move on into the Middle Ages. We have Henry II saying, "Will no one rid me of this pesky priest?" And then two of his henchmen left, crossed over, and then assassinated Thomas à Becket, a political assassination because he was uncomfortable for the regime of Henry II. And you go on to Henry VIII, and we have Thomas More, who made him very uncomfortable. And so Thomas More had to be taken care of. So we move through history then more closer to the present time when we deal with a man called Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence. Now, Lawrence lived in a place called Clouds Hill in Dorset, and he tried to remain as anonymous as he could. But he's the one man in British history who affronted and embarrassed the King of England, who held his magnificent ribbon to decorate him after the First World War and turned his back on the king and refused to take it. Joined the tank corps ultimately, and then made up his mind that he was going back to the Middle East to deal with his beloved Arabs. But beyond that, Henry Williamson, the Scottish fascist author, brought to him a letter from Adolf Hitler, who invited him to go to Berchtesgaden, because Hitler had identified Lawrence as the one man whom the British would accept as a dictator because he was such a national hero. So Lawrence became intolerable to the realm and he had to be eliminated. Another political assassination because MI5 hit him with a black Mariah after he had sent a telegram to Williamson saying, come on up for tea on Tuesday. So there goes Lawrence of Arabia, as he was called by Lovell Thomas, and as we came to know him, and he was finished. So these are examples of political assassinations that one has to keep very clearly in mind, because I've come to believe that political assassination is the last resort. If they can get rid of you one way or another, diminish you, de-emphasize your work, they'll do that. Scandals, arrests, whatever, they will do that. But if they can't get rid of you that way, and you insist on challenging and become a serious threat to whatever power structure there is, then that's where assassination comes in. I'm about to turn in the later years now to what happened to Mr. Roosevelt. And I won't go into detail here, but what I have learned is staggering in terms of what really happened to Mr. Roosevelt at Warm Springs. Roosevelt had a plan of action to implement after the Second World War, at the end of his days. He could not be allowed to implement that plan because it would have resulted in the indictments of Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, John McCloy. Go down the list of the henchmen of the forces that ruled this country. And Roosevelt was going after all of them. 30 Rockefeller Plaza, where Allen Dulles was given his rooms to work, Bill Stevenson had him wired and the entire floor wired. And they knew that Dulles, as Arthur Goldberg has said, the Dulles brothers were serious traitors and should have been tried. And Mr. Roosevelt was going after them. So we have those kinds of situations that have emerged throughout history. So without dwelling on it, I just want you to all understand that I firmly believe that, and has been, this historical use of political assassination throughout human society. And that we shouldn't be surprised with what happened in this country in the 1960s, which my colleagues are going to talk to you about. I thought when Martin was killed in 1968, they got the right guy. And they traced him, they arrested him, they tried him. I thought they got the right guy. That was 1968. I had known him only from 1967 when I came back from Vietnam as a journalist, and Ramparts published this article of mine called The Children of Vietnam. Martin was a subscriber to Ramparts. He asked to meet with me. He wept when he saw the photographs. He wept when he saw what his government was doing. That was in February of 1967. And on April 4th of 1967, he delivered his famous speech at Riverside Church, where he came out hard against the war. He then, at that point, said to me, can you stay with me and help develop a new politics movement? Which I agreed. And we had a convention in Chicago with over 5,000 delegates, and we were going to launch the King Spock ticket, which I first asked masses of people in front of the UN to consider on April 15th, 1967, 11 days after Martin delivered his speech there. How naive we were. I look back and it's almost laughable at how stupid we were, because we didn't realize the extent to which the government would infiltrate and subvert and destroy a movement. So when the Black Caucus was founded at that convention in Chicago, and Martin was delivering the opening address, the keynote speech, a note gets passed to me over my shoulder, get him out of here, or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world. They had to get rid of him from that convention because he was a unifier. They had to finish him. So we had to get him out. I told Andy, we have to get him out of here in order to avoid that kind of brutal embarrassment that was being led by the Blackstone Rangers, the Chicago gang. How naive we were. So out he goes, and then that same caucus starts introducing resolutions that split the movement terribly and made sure that there would not be any effective political opposition to Lyndon Johnson. So that went on and on. And eventually, Martin decided he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington, not to march, but to camp. and to visit the Congress, their congresspeople, and try to get put back into the budget monies that were taken out of the social programs because the war needed those monies. And the military knew that he might lose control of that because they weren't going to get that money back. And there was going to be mounting frustration, and that could lead to the same type of revolutionary turmoil that the world saw in Paris not so long before that. Lyndon Johnson didn't have André Malraux, who was able to deal with de Gaulle and to co-opt that movement. But Lyndon was going to rely on the military and the police to suppress it. But they didn't have the troops. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more. They didn't have the troops for that. They didn't have the troops to put down what they saw was going to be a serious revolution on the streets of Washington. So Martin King was assassinated because he opposed the war in Vietnam, but was hitting the bottom lines of a number of American corporations, and two, because he was going to bring this mass of humanity to Washington, and that could lead to the revolution. So they made up their minds early on that he had to go. So what did they do? They profiled the Missouri State Penitentiary System, Hoover's request, and they found an ideal patsy, guy who was a con man. He was a convicted criminal who could be manipulated and controlled and used and moved around. And that, of course, was James Earl Ray. So they took James and they used him as the patsy. He escaped more than a year before the actual assassination. They moved him around the country. Martin was originally to have been killed in Los Angeles. They kept James in Los Angeles for a long time. The two military special ops guys who were the backup team did not kill him, but were the backup team, were also housed in Los Angeles for the fateful day. The problem was, as I came to realize in later years, there was another assassination going to take place in California a couple of months after Martin, and that was, of course, the assassination of Bob Kennedy. It wouldn't do to have two of those take place in the same city. So they switched around. The military guys didn't know why they were ordered to move to New Orleans and Memphis, but they were. James was moved to New Orleans and then eventually into Memphis. And Memphis, under Frank Holloman as director of police and fire, was where the assassination of Martin King was to take place. Whereas lawn was cleared for Bob to be hit in Los Angeles when he was, as expected, he would win the Los Angeles primary. So they set that stage very well. They gave Ray credentials. They gave him a handler. The name of the handler is a fellow called Raul. People said, oh, Raul, oh, he made this guy up. Raul wasn't made up. Raul was a real guy. He was an operative who came out of Portugal. He worked for Portuguese intelligence in Angola. He was brought into the United States. He was given a job. He did their bidding. I was eventually able to find witnesses who knew Raul. I located where he lived. He lived in Yonkers, New York, would you believe? His name was Raul Coelho. Fairly recently, not so long ago, he died. But Raul was the handler for James and moved him around, gave him money, told him what to do. So they set all of this up. And I thought when Martin was killed, it was a lone nut. How naive, right? That's where my naivete stretches, I'm afraid. But I believe that they had the right guy when they got him. And I just walked away. We buried Martin. Ben Spock and I went down to Atlanta. We buried Martin. Bobby asked me to come up into his suite and talk about handling or working on his presidential campaign. And I said, no, I was through. Finished with politics. That was it for me. I walked away. 9 years later, Abernathy and I, who talked regularly over the years, and Abernathy said, look, I'd like you to go to the prison with me and interrogate Ray. And I said, what are you, gone around the bend? He said, no. I said, do you think there's any reason why he might? He said, I don't know, but I'd like you to go. I have some uneasiness. And I didn't understand what was behind Ralph's request at that time. That's further naivete on my part. Ralph was diminishing his position in SCLC. And this was perhaps a chance for him to refurbish his own image. So I said, okay, but I don't know anything about the case. It took me 6 months to prepare. Finally, in 78, in August, we went up to the prison. I interrogated James for 5 hours with Jim Lawson and Mark Lane, who was representing James at the time, and Ralph was there. So we finished that five-hour session with a firm belief that James was not the shooter, but didn't know what role he might have played knowingly. Anyway, he wasn't the shooter. But he raised enough questions that I started in 1978 all those years ago, right? 1978, going into Memphis, quietly, on the streets, in the bars, talking to people who knew things that went on there. And more I learned, more and more questions became answered and new questions arose. And I would go visit James in prison, and he kept asking me to represent him. Mark took it as far as he could, and he left. So I said, no, I won't represent you until I'm sure you had nothing to do with this killing at all. That took 10 years, 78 to 88. Finally, I became convinced that this guy really was a patsy. Everything about him was that. So I took him on in 1988 as a client. We went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, having lost at the Federal District Court, went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then to the Supreme Court for cert. We lost everything. We didn't have a shot at winning at all. I worked on it. I got Thames Television because I had moved to England. I moved my young family to England in 1981 because I was tired of having my four-year-old son pick up the phone and hearing threats on his father's life and asking me who those guys were on the beach and who were those two guys over there in the duck blind on the other side of the road who every time I left, somehow their binoculars hit the sun and they were following me. This is no way to raise little kids. So I left and I went to England in 81. I became a visiting scholar at the Wilson College, Cambridge, and I kept commuting. And they had basically a peaceful life over there. I raised that first family in England. I lived there for 20 years. But the more I came back and the more I learned, the more it became evident to me that James Earl Ray was totally innocent of this crime and that somebody else was very much involved in the crime. So I did the first book in 1995, Orders to Kill. And that put forth everything that we learned up to the point of 1995, which meant the television trial that lasted for 10 days. Hickman Ewing was the prosecutor. Unscripted trial, jury chosen from all over the country. It took them 7.5 hours to find Ray not guilty. I thought Hickman was going to have a heart attack. This is unheard of, right? And we had a smattering of the evidence that we eventually got, but was not guilty. Then the doors opened and more evidence and people came forth and the evidence picked up and led to James Earl Ray being met by the King family, by Dexter King. King family then coming out full-blown publicly asking for a trial for James Earl Ray. He died in 1988 in prison. We failed to get him a trial. 1999, we brought an actual civil action, went on in Memphis for 30 days, 70 witnesses that clearly up to 2003 set all the information up as to how Martin King was killed, what we knew at that point in time. It was devastating stuff. Mainstream media, of course, woefully ignores all of this. They would come in when Coretta was testifying or Dexter or Andy Young, and then they would leave when the heavy evidence and witnesses started to appear. They would just go. Court TV was nowhere to be found. Oh, they were going to televise it because they were nowhere to be found. It was not reported, not devastated. It took the jury 59 minutes after 30 days and 70 witnesses. It took them 59 minutes to find that Martin King was killed by a conspiracy involving agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. And of course, a low-level guy whom we sued called Lloyd Jowers, who owned the grill behind which Martin was killed. And it was Jowers who took the rifle from the shooter and brought it in and broke it down in front of his lover, who finally, 30 years later, finally admitted to me exactly what had happened. And the reason she was quiet all those years, because she thought Jowers himself had been the shooter. But Jowers was the main defendant. That gave us the basis for that lawsuit, you see. Okay. So I ran that story in a book called Act of State, An Act of State. That was published in 2003. And this is that book. And it put forward all of the evidence of the trial. The court reporter also put out a book called The 13th Juror. One of your colleagues here has that book. That has the whole transcript of the trial. Every bit of evidence in the trial was there. So that was 2003, right? So here we go from 1978 to 2003, and we have an enormous amount of information about how Martin King was killed. And I would have thought that's enough, but it wasn't enough, because all of a sudden, people are getting close to the grave. And if you write a book on these cases, and you do it in 3 or 4 years, and you get it out, and you sell it, you maybe make some money with some of the bravado, you may be doing a service. But if you somehow hang on to a case for 30 years or 35 years, and in this case, really, it's 38 years, and you're there, and you keep going in and out of Memphis, and you know people who've never talked to you before, but all of a sudden they're getting close to dying, and they now have something to say, then more and more evidence comes out. And more evidence comes out when the son of a Dixie Mafia operative who was responsible for bringing the money in from Hoover and dispensing these funds to local people, including people like the Reverend William Samuel Billy Kiles, who died recently, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's still alive, because of services they will perform for the money. And here you have this young boy. He was 8, 9, and he's there, and it's seeing Clyde Tolson. How many of you know who Clyde Tolson was? Huh? Clyde Tolson was the guy whom, as you know, Hoover's number two, Hoover's lover, Hoover's trusted confidant. It was Tolson who was the guy who came all in and out, bringing the money, working with Frank Holloman, setting everything up. So here comes these new witnesses, this new Dixie Mafia family, and the head of the family died, and now the son is that much older. And he wants to get this off his chest. So he comes to me and he tells me what happened. From his standpoint, he has a particular piece of information. He knows what happened. Because he rode with his father to the prison carrying $25,000 to the warden of the prison to organize James Earl Ray's escape after James had been profiled. And he was there, his father. And he sat in. He brought the donuts and the coffee. And he sat in. He saw all these things. And he remembered them. And he was down on Mulberry Street on a bike when Martin was shot. And Earl Clark, who was a lieutenant in the Memphis Police Department, came down over the wall and ran up the street to get into a waiting police car to take him away. But Earl Clark was not the killer of Martin King. He was the spotter. And he was there doing his job as a spotter. The killer of Martin King was the best shot on the Memphis Police Department. He was paid a fairly small amount of money. He was an ex-Vietnam vet. Brother was killed in Vietnam. He hated black people. He behaved abysmally in terms of black people in the south side of Memphis. And he was readily recruited. And I had eyewitnesses who saw him the day of the shooting practicing early morning until he left around 3 o'clock at the Memphis Armory Police Department shooting range, and he left in his buddy's car, put the rifle in the back seat, which was described to my eyewitness, who was a custodian, black custodian, as a very special gun. Off he went, and he was the guy who shot Martin King. I had lunch with him. I asked him to have lunch with me. He needs money. So he agreed to have lunch with me for $500. I paid him $500, and we had lunch. He wouldn't eat, and he sat there. And I said, you know, I have some witnesses who say, you were the shooter. This is what you did. You killed Martin King. What do you have to say to that? And he said, I don't have anything to say to that. I said, well, you know, we got 2 plaster of Paris footprints where the shooter ran back toward an alleyway. It had rained the night before, and they got these footprints. And the size of those footprints, size 13. Now tell me, Frank, what size shoe do you wear? He said, 13 large, and he had a little grin on his face. But that's as far as I got in terms of getting out of him. However, I knew another taxi driver for years, 25 years. And I said, I want you know Frank, you know who he is. He says, yeah, drives a taxi. I said, oh, yeah. Okay, I want you to just get in and confront him, see what he says. Guy got in the back of his car one day and said, hey, I hear they're going to get you. I hear you're going to be indicted. Pepper's got enough evidence on you to get you. And he said, what are they going to get me for? Something I did 30 years ago? I just blurted this out. Something I did 30 years ago? I said, oh, my goodness. So, of course, we got a statement, an affidavit statement of that. But he's free. He's walking around. He still needs money. We only paid him $5,000 for the hit on Martin King. But That in those days seemed to be a lot of money, and he was happy to get it. So that it takes us up to a point, and I can't go really much beyond that point because that's in the third book, the final book in the trilogy, which will be out on June 7th. And that book culminates in the most depressing news of all that I have, because Martin King was not killed by that bullet that he took in the head. And I can't tell you any more than that, except I have the eyewitness details of how he actually died. And that is perhaps the most depressing part of my story with respect to Martin King's death. I don't want to go into that at this point in time. So that's as much as I can tell you, one, about the history of assassinations. Political assassinations are as virtually as old as human society. All the ones we had in the 60s were part and parcel. The difference is that the cover-ups that have taken place with respect to the assassination of Martin King, and of course John Kennedy and Bob Kennedy, and I am today Sirhan's lawyer. I took on Sirhan only when I became convinced, again, that he was a patsy. And I have to tell you that the evidence against him is so much less convincing. What's happened to Sirhan is the end of the Sixth Amendment in the United States, so far as I'm concerned. We have just lost at the Ninth Circuit. We're going to the Supreme Court. But it's clear he's a political prisoner. His own lawyer was under a pending indictment and threw the case entirely. Grant Cooper threw the case, collaborated with the prosecution, made sure that Sirhan would be convicted. The difference is that Sirhan, though profiled like Ray was also subjected to mind control. And we believe we know where that took place and even who did that and how he was subjected. And that's why he has this gap. Every parole hearing I've been at with Sirhan, I've been his counsel for the last two parole hearings. He honestly does not remember a period of time after he was pinched by his handler on the neck. He doesn't remember what happened after that. But we've been able to find 12 witnesses who always saw him in front of Bob. And of course, Bobby was hit with bullets fired at powder burn range from behind, by someone kneeling down behind him. So there's no question that Sirhan did not kill Bobby. But the cover-up is there. So we had these attempts to cover up, but nothing as sophisticated as we have seen with respect to the assassinations of the 60s. I've not been involved in the John Kennedy one. I deliberately stayed away from that one. I stayed away from Malcolm, although I know the family. I stayed away from it, would not get involved, because the more you get involved in these cases, one, the more it impoverishes you personally, because there's no money to pay for any of this. And also, the more you get maligned and attacked as a conspiracy nut, no matter how much the facts are there and back you up, you get maligned as a conspiracy nut. So it's better to focus on a limited number of them. I'm sorry to say, it takes others like colleagues here and others whom you know, like Jim Douglas and people like that, who will carry forward work on the other cases. But have no illusions. Political assassination is well in the history of mankind, and you can expect more of these in the future. I spent a lot of time in Latin South America. You all know, or many of you may know, the history of Salvador Allende, Archbishop Romero. And I have to tell you, Hugo Chavez was like a brother to me. I was very close to Hugo. And I have a lot of information about how Hugo got his cancer that killed him after 18 months. And I desperately tried to get Hugo away from the Spanish doctors who came to Cuba and get him into another situation. But he was convinced that the Spanish doctors were going to take care of him. So he had chemotherapy and the radiation, which is associated with cancer treatments generally and known to fail. And of course it failed and Hugo died. So we've had our share in this hemisphere of assassinations. They will continue, and you only can expect nothing else from a power structure that wants to control the world.
And again, you've just been listening to a speech given by Dr. William Pepper at the Left Forum in May of 2016. I highly recommend that you get a copy of his new book, The Plot to Kill King. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power! To the people!